that's better. Hello, hello. Okay, I can hear myself. Today is March 7th. Today is March 7th, 2008. It's a Friday. This is an interview with Tema Okun, with Bridget Burge as the interviewer. This is part of the project Heirs to a Fighting Tradition, Oral Histories of North Carolina Social Justice Activists. This is the fourth interview with Tema in this series. The first was on May 16th, 2007, the second on June 22nd, 2007, the third on September 14th, 2007, and now the fourth today, March 7th, 2008. We are doing this interview again at Tema's home on Rigsby Avenue in Durham, North Carolina. So now if you would, I hear,
yeah, what is that?
Something was reversing, it sounded the beeping. So now if you'll say, your name and the date, and describe yourself a little bit so I can check sound while you do it.
Okay, my name is Tema Okun. The date is March 7th, 2008. We are in my kitchen at 204 Rigsby Avenue in downtown Durham.
Describe the weather today in our
The weather is nice and rainy today. I'm hoping it will continue to rain. And I am still dressed in my workout clothes from this morning. I probably smell. But luckily that doesn't come through on the audio tape. And Bridget is wearing a green sweatshirt-like thingy. It looks very official in her earphones.
I haven't bathed today, so I probably smell. But I haven't worked out either. Okay, so now I'm going to do about 1 minute of just background noise, okay? Shh.
Okay.
Sounds good. The levels sound good. Okay. So I guess before we really dive in, your dad has passed away, which is probably one of the biggest things in your life since the last time that we spoke. And I missed the memorial service, and which I couldn't come to. I regret that. But what were some things that you really appreciated about that, or what were some highlights from the memorial service from your dad, or anything you want to say about this journey in the last few months?
It was really nice. I think dad turned 90 in June of last year, and we had a big party for him, which was really great. It was his idea. He wanted a big party, so we said, okay, yeah, let's have a big party. And the university helped plan the party, so a lot of people came, and so he got to see a lot of people when he was alive, which was wonderful. And and for the memorial service, a lot of people also came, and you know, I knew that my dad was accomplished, and I knew that he was, you know, a big cheese in his field, but I don't think until he died, I really quite grasped how beloved he was by so many people. And one thing my brother pointed out in his comments at the services were, he pointed out how Dad was beloved by people from all walks of life. So, you know, the his peers in the environmental engineering world, and but then people who he met at Carol Woods, you know, in his last couple of months he was in and out of assisted living and in and out of the health center, and you know, formed really strong relationships with the people who were caring for him, and who all have made, not all, but you know, many made a real effort to talk to us and let us know how much they liked our father. And and I, you know, and so the people who came to the services were from all walks of life and all different kinds of interests. He was interested in a lot of different things, and it was just really amazing. And then the services were nice too, because he was a rabid atheist. So he, somebody came up to us afterwards, one of his old friends, and said, "Well, you managed to get through a whole, first funeral I've been to where there wasn't a single mention of God." So we managed to do that, and we just had, you know, I spoke, and my brother spoke, and his two grandchildren spoke, and his brother spoke, and then Dan Pollitt, who was a friend and colleague of his probably his best friend, and a great activist in the civil rights movement. Essentially, we asked him to talk about our father's activism. So Dan Pollitt, in Dan Pollitt style, started giving a little speech about the history of the civil rights movement in Chapel Hill, which was incredibly interesting, but not really on topic. So we kept trying to make motions, like, you know, and he was going on and on and on. And Tom, my husband and partner, emceed, and he did it. He was very graceful about it, the way he got Dan off of. So there were some humorous moments, and it was just very, what the grandkids said were really. Will told a story. He had gone to Africa this summer and had to miss the party, but he told a story about how, when he was in the, you know, middle of very rural, the Congo, very rural area, and he introduced himself. Somebody said, "Oh, are you related to Dan Okun?" You know, and how. That, you know, that was a nice story. And the other grandchild, Joe Dan, talked about how Dad was considered quite the catch at Carol Woods, and we all laughed about that. And it was really, you know, my family has always had a great sense of humor, so there was a lot of laughter. There was a lot of, I put together a little PowerPoint of slides of him and pictures of him, and that was really nice. And so it was good. It was very good.
I can hear the teapot breathing a little.
Oh, you can?
Is that what it is? Can I turn it off? Or
you can unplug it. I don't know if you might have to just move it out of the room.
Okay, hold on.
Whoa.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Okay, hang on just a second.
I think it might just, even if you unplug it, but even if you do that.
It might still be.
Can you hear it?
Not now.
Yeah.
It was just for a couple minutes earlier, and it stopped. Okay. Well, good. Thanks for sharing about that. Mm-hmm. Nice. Sounds like it was really nice.
It was. It was great. I mean, as funerals go.
Yeah.
Or services go, or whatever.
Yeah. So when, totally shifting gears, okay. Prepare yourself. When you look back on some grassroots efforts that you've been a part of, is there one or two that really stands out as being like, yeah, if we could repeat this, you know, we'd really make some strides? And are there, and what are the reasons for that, if there are?
Well, I mean, I'll answer this in my own way, because I'm not sure I think about it in terms of strides. And I no longer believe that there's a way to do, you know, we've talked about this before, I don't believe that there's, for me, it's that there's a way that I could describe, or what stand, another, so forget all that. Nikki, leave that out. for what I want to say is that for me, what stands out are moments. And the moments that stand out are the ones where we, as a group, for whatever reasons, were able to like move through a kind of a formal place into a tangible space of love. It's all I can say. And I think about a workshop that James Williams and I did. We were working with some people from South Carolina, and people who were living, some funder was giving a lot of money for people from low-income communities to come together and do some planning. And we went with a bunch of people from these different communities to a retreat center somewhere in rural South Carolina. And we had 2 or 3 days together. And I just remember that one afternoon, and I don't like to talk for, I don't like to claim other people's experiences, except that people talked about this afterwards, that there was a quality of our, we broke through sort of fear, we broke through our not knowing of each other, we broke through, and we got to this place of just, again, palpable love in the room. People had taken incredible risks talking about who they were and what they were struggling with, having to do with drugs and, you know, poverty and all just all the different challenges that people were facing, the bravery that people had, the courage that people had, the love that people had as people were sharing, the humor, the laughter. There was just this level of it was, and so to me, that's when, you know, if I feel, if I think about a better world, what I think about is a world where more and more of those kinds of moments are possible. And I think people want them and long for them. And everybody that I talked to from the group afterwards, I remember taking a long walk with one of the women in the from the workshop the next time I came to town, and talking about how her brother, who was in the workshop too, had gone back to drugs since the workshop. And I was just trying to think about how, you know, how if he had been able, and he was one of the most vibrant participants and one of the more, somebody who'd really taken a lot of risks, and how if we had been able to sustain that space a little bit more, he might have had more of a chance. And not that I know anything about overcoming drug addiction, but just that the power in that room was really strong. So, and I can think about, so that's what I think about more than a stride or an organization did this and then they moved to this place, and so that taught me this. Although having said that, I will say, and I think I've probably also said this before, the places where I feel like I've seen the most movement in organizational culture or organizational policies or organizational procedures is where there have been really strong, committed leaders, people who are willing to do, to stick with something even when the people around them are afraid or critical, you know. And and I think I'm starting to write a little bit about this in my, for my dissertation, and it's just giving me the idea that I need to go to talk to one of them, that it would be interesting to have a better understanding of what makes it possible for some people to do that, which I feel like I don't know. I have very, very little information. I mean, in my paper already, I've sort of talked about what makes it possible for a Dr. King to be a Dr. King, or a Leslie Feinberg to be a Leslie Feinberg, or a, you know, any of these people who have, or I think about, in my class, I show this film called Remember Me, Lai, which is a very powerful film about, that a British documentary group put together, where they went back and they interviewed 3 or 4 people who had participated in the My Lai massacre, soldiers. And there was one soldier that they interviewed. So almost every soldier participated in this massacre. And they were young, they were, you know, 19, 20 years old, and the whole thing is just an incredible tragedy. And one of the interviewees is completely mentally gone. And he, you know, he sits in the front of the camera, and he's, his whole body is shaking, and he's got a whole table of medicine pills in front of him, and he's got a notebook that he's kept of images of all these things that he did to people, and he just can't, you know, he was 20 years old. There's this picture of him at 20, and he's just young and bright-eyed and beautiful, and he can't come to terms with what he's done. And he really feels it. And then there's a, then they have other degrees of, then they have another man who feels perfectly comfortable about everything that he did and feels like it, that he was following orders, and that was the, it wasn't about being moral or not being moral, it was about following orders. And then another guy who was kind of in the middle. And then they interviewed this other guy, clearly, well, visually anyway, at least working class, if not low income, missing some teeth. So this is many years later, 20 years later now. Older, an African-American man, as was the guy who was so shaken up. And he refused the orders. He said, you know, when they told me what to do, I said, I'm not going to do this. And they said, well, you're going to be up for court-martial. And he said, well, I'm not going to, you know, court-martial me then. I'm not going to do this. And when the interviewer asked him, well, why did you do that? And he said, well, because it was wrong. And, you know, I was raised, I'm a red-blooded American, just like all the other men in my platoon. And, you know, no red-blooded American would think that this was the right thing to do. I mean, it was just so, and so what made it possible for this man, it's, you know, some people like to believe it has to do with education level or some higher level, quote-unquote higher level of whatever. And for all I know, he was very well educated, but he didn't appear to be. And he appeared to be really, really clear about what the right thing to do was. So what made it possible for him to be that clear about it in the face of incredible peer pressure to behave differently? You know, and I think if it was me, I have no idea what I would do. And my inclination is that I would not overtly resist the orders. I would probably, I don't know what I would do, but I know that I'm very susceptible to peer pressure. I want to please people around me. And so what makes it possible for somebody to, so that's, you know, those are the kinds of things I'm interested in. I don't feel like I have any answers at this point about lessons in terms of great strides. I think it's more around, I feel like it's important for people to have some level of self-awareness, but even that, you know, some level of self-awareness and some level of an ability to put themselves in other people's shoes. I don't know how useful that is.
Useful, thanks. It's starting to rain more, so if we can take like 30 seconds just to get the sound, it's beautiful, and we can use the audio. Nikki can use that for audio too.
Okay.
Plus, that's just a upsetting story. I mean, it's also powerful. But
yeah,
man,
it's an amazing movie.
I'm glad I'm not in your class. I have to watch it. I'm just kidding.
It's a nice sound.
So I want to get a little bit about your impressions of the AIRS Leadership Retreat on Saturday. So if you could start by saying, at the AIRS Leadership Retreat this Saturday. Sorry, I got to get better at doing that because Nikki's. So just thoughts about what it was like to be there or highlights for you?
Well, at the AIRS Leadership Retreat last Saturday, I really do think that the storytelling we did in the morning was incredibly powerful. And part of what I'm talking about in terms of the ability to transform a room full of people and bring us all to a deep appreciation of who we are, and the complexity of who people are, and what people are dealing with. I thought that was really powerful. And so, I mean, I think that's really my main impression. I think that it's interesting. I went to a meeting. There was a meeting downtown Durham. As more and more people move down here, we're starting to form a residence association, or some kind of association. It's very controversial. I mean, not controversial, but you know, lots of conversation about what kind of association it should be, and should it include business owners, blah blah blah. And so I go to the meeting, and the contrast was intense. I mean, you know, you have this room full of people who don't really know each other. We go around and tell each other's names, and then one person sort of facilitates the meeting, and people, I mean, there was no grounding in who people were at all. And there was no cultural, I mean, I had a fleeting thought, well, maybe I should try and do something here. And there was no cultural cradle for it, really. It would have been a huge shift, and I didn't have the energy to pull it off. And just think, and you know, and so a lot of people were coming at the different issues from a lot of different directions, and there was no no quilt, no bed, no cradle, no ground from which we could understand. You know, we were just sort of debating people's point of views. And at one point somebody said, well, we have to come up with our Robert Rules of Orders procedures. And I said, no. I said, I will not. What did I say? I said something like, I'm over it. There's no way I'm going to consent to Robert Rules of Order. I was just like completely uncivil. But it was like, oh my God, Robert's Rules of Order. So I think just this whole ability of expanding the notion that people can be in a space with each other very differently is a really valuable notion. And you know, and then this group has to have a relationship with City Council, which is even further from any notion of, you know, real dialogue. So,
And you touched on this a little bit, but if you were just to let go and get flowery, what's your vision of a liberated world?
I want to go get my poem.
Yeah. Do it. Oh, I'll help you.
Okay. Well, can I just pull this out?
No, it'll scream. Okay. So, yeah, you're right.
Well, why don't you, actually, I can tell you where
it
is.
Yeah, okay.
It's on that big table. I think there's a black spiral-bound notebook. It's my journal. Do you see it? I also, is this still on?
Yeah.
I also, at last Saturday's AIRS retreat, I loved Lou's poem, poetry reading. And one idea I would encourage is that there are lots of people write poetry. It's unbelievable to me how many people write poetry. I mean, it's a wonderful thing. And I was just, when I first realized that, I remember being kind of like shocked, but that it might be really cool to invite at every little intersection to invite somebody who either has written a poem or something to share it, because it's just, his stuff was very powerful. So I wrote a poem because somebody else asked me the vision question. I'm turning pages, that's what you're hearing, Nikki. Okay. And I'm trying to remember what I wrote this for. Oh, I think I wrote it in my poetry group. This is what I wrote. So this is my vision as of January 2008. People laugh deep and wide from their bellies as they sit together at the table, loving the smells of the fresh food lingering and the comfort of the sweet tea as it soothes our throats. We laugh knowing that we are cared for. We laugh because tomorrow our work calls and the doing of it fills our bellies as this meal has done. We laugh because we have learned to love well, to see our neighbors as ourselves and ourselves as they might. We laugh because we have enough, all of us, and justice is now the bed we lie on in the dark, blissful night.
It's beautiful.
So, you know, when I think about a vision, I think I would say I'm not a pragmatist. I'm not a pragmatist in the least. And I've been thinking a lot as I get older about what my skills are and what my weaknesses are and, you know, where I have something to contribute and where I should probably stay completely silent. I'm not a pragmatist. So what I have to offer is sort of my idealism and my ability to have images about what I think is possible or desirable in my vision anyway. And so that's why I wrote the poem the way I did. I think for me, and I just read this great book called The Great Turning by David Corton, where he spends half the book talking about our history of 5,000 years of history of empire, and then he talks about how, you know, that empire was a constructed choice made by the powerful elite in order to benefit them, and that there's a partnership. He calls it Earth Community. Earth Community is the alternative that he aspires to and talks about, a partnership model and a model that's not based on domination but on a recognition of interdependence. So all of that is stuff that I really, you know, agree with and believe in. I think for me, the thing that I think more about, the skills that we have to acquire if we're going to, culturally, that we have to acquire. Bless you. The skills that we have to acquire if we're going to make what I call this cultural, he calls it the Great Turning and has all these aspects, but if I believe anything, I believe that we have to, which is why the story circle is so powerful, is we have to figure out how to transform culture. Because culture is what holds us all together, sort of the ability of culture to establish what we think is normal and desirable. And I think that the skills that we have to learn are, foremost for me, are the ability to love ourselves and each other as ourselves, whatever that might mean. But this real ability to retain our identity, whatever's important to us, historically or for whatever reasons, both sort of identities based on race, class, and gender, identities based on ethnicity, identities based even on nation states, although I don't think those are such a good idea, but to understand that we can have an identity, but it doesn't have to be in opposition to other people, which is, I think, is our idea now, that identity is in opposition to, or has to do with domination over or being dominated. And so, so I would say this ability to really cultivate love for other people and to hold the contradictions of having both our own identities and knowing that we are part of a global community, and being able to traverse so many of these really fragile contradictions. So that, and I think the third thing is really learning to live in the fuzziness of lack of clarity. You know, and again, I think our culture, Western culture, is really addicted to this idea that very complex things can be simple, they can be torn apart, you know, they can be scientifically sliced apart and then understood in these discrete pieces, and that's not how it is at all. And, you know, I don't know if when we talked about my queer theory class, did we talk about how we know somebody's gay? Did I talk about that? One of the things that really struck me in my queer theory class. And, you know, I'm one of these people, I also learn very slowly. I have to have concepts introduced to me sometimes for decades before I really get them. And so this is one of those really huge aha moments in the queer theory class when I read this passage where somebody wrote, and I've tried to find it, I can't find it again, but someone very wise wrote, at what point do we know that we're gay? Or does somebody know that somebody else is gay? Is it the point at which I look at you with longing? Is it the point at which our hands brush? Is it the point at which we kiss? Is it the point at which we have genital contact? Is it the point at which we have genital contact 10 times? I mean, it's absurd. You know, just like the race construct is absurd. It's absurd that that we would try and have these discrete categories for people who are so complex, and to try and put people's desire or gender feelings about their own gender into these boxes makes no sense. And the only reason it makes sense is in order to use it for domination purposes. So I think this ability, and what happens, I feel like, is that as we learn to organize ourselves in opposition to empire, we adopt these very same, you know, so as oppositional groups or as resistance groups, we'll create our own stringent categories that people have to belong to or not belong to in order to be, you know, right on or whatever. And it's just, it's this, so there's something about learning to live with the messiness and complexity and fuzziness that we all are, again, while understanding that there are places where we're going to hold our ground. So, you know, it's just all of those things, I think, are things that we have to learn. And so when I think about my role as a teacher, I'm thinking about how do I help myself to learn these things? How do I support other people to learn these things?
So staying on the path of looking ahead, what else is next for you?
Well, I think that's it. I mean, very specifically, what I'm at the end of my classwork for my dissertation, and I'm getting a dissertation because I need the credentialing to get a job. In a culture that thinks learning has to do with credentialing. So I'm trying to hold the contradiction of living within the constraints of this educational and cultural system that I think is completely full of crap, making the most of it. And I'm delighted to be in my program, and I feel very fortunate to be in the program I'm in. So the next year is going to be spent writing about all what I've just talked about, and trying to understand it better myself. My internal struggle with it has to do with, and we talked some about this idea of a community class, and I think I'm trying to understand my own activism, and I've realized that I don't feel like writing a dissertation is legitimate activism. And it's a struggle for me because legitimate according to who? Like, there's some judge and jury out there that even cares what the fuck, excuse me, Nikki, I'm doing. And nobody gives a shit what I'm doing, you know? So it's like, why do I think there's some judge and jury out there going, well, Temma shouldn't be, if she's going to be an activist and we're going to check that off, then writing a dissertation is not going to make it. So, I mean, it's like, nobody cares. So that's interesting. And it's also interesting because I find, as I've never been intellectually engaged the way I have with this program before. I've always had a pretty miserable experience in school. And I love this program, and I've been very stimulated by it, and I'm very excited about what I'm going to be writing about. So there's this whole other part of me that just wants to write and really devote my energies to that. And so I'm trying to figure out my attitude towards all of this, because I have conflicting my desire conflicts with my judge. So.
Will you say the name of the school and the program that you're in?
I'm at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro in the Educational Foundations. Oh, no. I can never remember what it's called. It's called ELC. Educational Foundations and Leadership. Educational Leadership. I know, here it is. Educational Leadership and Cultural Foundations. So that you can see why I can't remember it. I mean, what does that mean?
Educational Leadership and
Cultural Foundations.
Okay, we say it one more time.
I am in the program at UNC Greensboro in Educational Leadership and Cultural Foundations. It's a small program, a doctoral program within the larger education department, and it's flush with very great lefty critical thinking professors, and it's just wonderful.
Is there anything that I know that you can remember over the last year that we've been doing this, but is there anything that you'd like to talk about that we haven't touched on?
Oh my God, no. God. Right now, I'm thoroughly bored.
We didn't talk
Nikki,
about...
I apologize to you. You must be thoroughly bored.
We didn't talk about how you feel about your feet, Emma. How do you feel about your
feet? My feet? I have no opinion whatsoever about my feet.
If you were conducting these interviews, or if we expand the AIRS collection, are there people that like pop to mind for you who you'd want to be interviewed?
I think it would be really great if you'd interview a woman named Mary Jackson, who's a minister, African American woman, an elder by now, in Chatham County, who I think would bring a lot. She's not, I don't think would consider herself a traditional activist, but she certainly is one. I mean, she's not traditional, but she's certainly someone who's been very active in her community, very important. I think who else? Vivette Jeffries Logan. She's a member of the Leadership Council of the Saponi, I'm going to get this wrong. Saponi tribe of the Okanichi Nation, or it might be the Okanichi tribe of the Saponi Nation. I think it's Saponi tribe of the Okanichi Nation, I think. She comes from the Okanichi people in Hillsboro. Saponi Okanichi people. I'm sure there are lots of people. My mind is blanking right now.
You're done.
I'm done.
Okay, well, thanks so much.
Eat more ice cream. That's the other other big advice I have for people.
I just saw in a Starhawk book, she said something like that they ended up doing this chant at, where was it, some nuclear plant they were trying to shut down. And, it was like, no to nuclear power. Hold the anchovies. Power. Hold the anchovies. Yeah. So it's like this power and holding the absurdity of life. Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing I think is in terms of, lessons or keys to strides or whatever, that this whole, I really admire people who are able to, Lou, and then in my class the other day, one of my students had another student whose name I need to find out come and give a spoken word poem presentation to the class about a young transgender woman who was killed in Newark, who nobody's ever heard about and whose name I have, because I didn't write it down, I have now forgotten. And it was just the most incredible piece, and this ability to channel rage and pain into this kind of expression. This one had, you know, was just raw and angry and beautiful, which I really love. And then the humor, the folks who can put the humorous twist on these really awful things also, like the chant you were just chanting. And I just really, I really admire that. So just, you know, having a sense of humor at all times is, not at all times, but frequently is very important.
Good. Thank you, Tina.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.